There are more wealthy men and women in America than in any other country, and the number is growing at a steady pace. According to the IRS, there are more than 1.4 million millionaires in the U.S., more than 80% of whom have made their money starting with nothing. By sometime in the 1990s, one out of every 100 families will have a net worth in excess of $1 million. Of the 205 billionaires in the world identified by Fortune magazine, 60 of these billionaires are Americans, and many of them are first-generation self-made billionaires. According to the research done by Dr. Thomas Stanley at the University of Georgia, covering a period of more than 15 years, between 50,000 and 100,000 men and women become millionaires every year, and most wealthy people are getting wealthier as the years pass. Now, here are a couple of questions for you. First, do you sincerely want to be rich? Because if you do, it also means that you must be willing to pay the price in terms of effort and sacrifice for a long time, probably more than 20 years, in order to achieve it. If you're not willing to pay this kind of a price, then you don't really want to be rich. You're merely entertaining yourself with a fantasy that's common to the great majority of men and women. The second question is this: why aren't you rich already? If you sincerely want to be rich, why aren't you? What is stopping you? Is it the height of your income, or is it the rate of your spending? When I talked about the laws of money, I covered many of the key ideas and principles that you must apply if you want to achieve financial independence. But if you want to be rich, you have to go much further. Theoretically, it's possible for you or anyone else to become rich, to achieve a net worth in excess of $1 million during the course of your working lifetime. All you have to do is to begin saving early enough and continue it long enough and shelter your savings from taxes as much as possible and let it build up until it passes the magic $1 million mark. Virtually anyone can do it, and many tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people are doing it right now. As a professional speaker and trainer and management consultant, and having worked with hundreds of corporations and many tens of thousands of individuals, I've met hundreds of millionaires and several billionaires. What I found out is that they're not very different from you and me, aside from the fact that they have more money and, as they say, a better class of problems. They're not any more intelligent, nor are they especially gifted. They are mostly ordinary men and women who have used their God-given abilities to an extraordinary degree in their chosen fields. They've developed themselves and their opportunities to a very high point and have done wonderful things with their financial lives. And there's nothing in this world that can stop you from joining them if you really want to. In an earlier session, I talked about the law of belief. This law simply says that your beliefs become your realities. Thoughts objectify themselves. Your thoughts held in your mind produce after their kind. What you really, deeply, and intensely believe tends to materialize in your experience. Your beliefs cause you to think and see and feel and behave in ways that tend to make your beliefs come true for you. Like most people, when I was in my teens, even though I came from a poor background, I had a dream of being a millionaire by the time I was 30. I've since learned that this is the American dream. Like most people, I traveled and worked and tried many things during the decade of my 20s. I switched back and forth searching for that elusive will-o'-the-wisp of financial riches. I eagerly looked for lucky breaks, and I tried various get-rich-quick schemes. I threw my heart and energy into a variety of enterprises looking for a fast way to reach that $1 million mark. Of course, like most people, which is more than 99% of the population, I didn't make it. When I was 30, I was deeply in debt, between jobs once more, and I didn't even have a high school diploma. As my 30s began, I set my goal to be a millionaire by the time I was 40. I then began to draw on my experience and to do a few things right, but the idea of achieving wealth was still just a dream. Then there came a turning point in my life. I'd been working very hard in business, still with the dream of someday becoming wealthy, when someone asked me to explain to them the qualities of self-made millionaires. I found that as I considered the question, all I could come up with were some platitudes about setting goals and working hard. This awareness of my own ignorance on the subject of wealth led me to begin studying men and women who had started from nothing and who had achieved financial independence. And here is where the law of belief came to work for me. It can do the same for you. I found that there was an enormous amount of documentation and information available on the rich. Apparently, the subject had fascinated many people before me. This is when my beliefs began to grow. Think about it. If you read one book about one person who had started from pretty much the same place you did and had become wealthy because of doing certain things in a certain way, you would develop a very small belief that it might be possible for you. If you then went on to read about 10 or 100 or 1,000 or tens of thousands of men and women who had started with very little and had worked their way up to positions of wealth and prestige, your belief, just like mine did, would begin to grow and deepen and intensify to the point where you could become absolutely convinced that you too had the capacity to achieve whatever financial goals you set for yourself. As I began studying wealthy Americans, and especially self-made millionaires, not only did I learn the cause and effect relationships, the things that they'd done to get where they were, but I also began to develop the belief that it was possible for me as well. My intensity of belief activated the law of attraction within me and began drawing into my life people and circumstances and ideas and resources that began to move me toward my financial goals and to move them toward me. All of the other laws of success and achievement that I've talked about began to work on my behalf. In just a few years, I was able to go from being broke to being financially independent. As I began sharing these ideas with others, they began to go from rags to riches as well. On a television show recently, several audience participants stood up and told their stories about what they'd accomplished after listening to my tapes. One woman, who was having serious problems in her life, quit drinking, joined Alcoholics Anonymous, left a bad relationship, lost 40 pounds, and tripled her annual income to more than $100,000, all in the space of less than 1 year. Another woman and her husband increased their net worth 30 times in 2 years. A third gentleman from Pakistan was broke and sleeping on the ground when someone let him listen to some of my audio cassettes. Within 4 years, he was a millionaire and the owner of two companies. All over the country, men and women by the hundreds and thousands have found that by applying some of these principles, they can make more progress in a couple of years than they might have made in an entire lifetime of hard work. There are a series of laws that apply to wealth creation, which you can use to achieve your financial goals. Every wealthy person lives his life in harmony with these laws, and every person suffering financial problems is breaking one or more of these laws and trying to get away with it. Unfortunately, it just doesn't work that way. The first law of wealth creation is the law of creative emulation. It says the key to achieving wealth is to study and emulate those who have already acquired it before you. Don't try to reinvent the wheel. Use proven success methods. The first part of this law says that what one person has done, others can do as well. Abraham Lincoln once said that some become wealthy is a sign to others that they may also become wealthy. For every activity in life, it's commonly understood that you copy the people who have already mastered the subject before you attempt to add your own variations or wrinkles to it. The second part of the law of creative emulation says that if you ask the experts for advice, they'll give it to you. Business philosopher Jim Rohn says poor people should take rich people out to lunch and pay the bill. Taking a wealthy, successful person out to lunch and asking him or her for advice or guidance on what you can do and how you can do it is the cheapest investment you can ever make. And what I've found is that winners will always help others to win. Successful people will always take time out of their busy schedules to help other people to be successful. The third part of the law of creative emulation says that you become what you most admire. One of the things that we know about wealthy men and women is that they place an extremely high value on the acquisition of material goods, and they very much admire and look up to other men and women who've acquired them as well. Sometimes people delude themselves by saying silly things like, well, I'd rather be happy than rich. They seem to think that people who make a lot of money are not particularly virtuous or happy. Well, I have news for you. The research has been done, and the results are in. The fact is that the wealthy are very, very happy. They may have problems and difficulties in their lives, but they are happier and healthier more of the time than people are who worry about money every single day. Many people have been misled into believing that people only achieve financial success by engaging in activities that are somehow illicit and unacceptable. This is disproven by the facts. More than 99% of all the men and women who've achieved wealth have done it by utilizing their talents and abilities to the maximum in the service of other people. The biggest fortunes in America have been built in fields like retail sales and food production and distribution, gasoline and oil distribution, real estate development, and transportation of people and goods and services. Many huge fortunes come from the development of media outlets like newspapers and television and radio stations. One of the best ways to become wealthy is summarized in the old saying, if you want to dine with the classes, you have to sell to the masses. The second law of wealth creation is the law of desire, which states that the motivation to acquire riches is an intense, burning desire for financial success. In order to achieve anything, you must be highly motivated, and all motivation requires a motive. The more powerful your motivation, the more likely it is that you'll persist in the face of all obstacles and disappointments toward attaining your objective. The first part of the law of desire says that if you want it badly enough, no one will be able to convince you that it's not possible. Perhaps the greatest negative influence in your life will be the people around you, many of them very well-meaning, but who will criticize and ridicule you for wanting to achieve so much above the ordinary. They'll point out every weakness and shortcoming in your plans and dreams. But if your desire is intense enough, you will be able to rise above them and carry on regardless. The second part of the law of desire says that desire is only expressed in your actions. It's not what you say, but what you do that counts. As I said before, everybody has the same dreams and desires, but very few people are taking actions consistent with them. You can tell if you really believe in your ability to become wealthy by the things that you do every single day. The wonderful thing is that when you take actions consistent with your desires, the actions themselves reinforce your belief that your desires are achievable. You can actually build yourself into an unstoppable, wealth-creating human machine by acting as if you already were one. The third part of the law of desire says that the more often you affirm your goal and visualize it as a reality, the more intense your desire will be. The third law of wealth creation is the law of purpose. To quote Napoleon Hill, it says that definiteness of purpose is the starting point of all riches. Definiteness of purpose means establishing a clear, well-defined goal of financial achievement for yourself, supported by a plan and backed by action. Setting your goal of wealth creation as your major definite purpose in life is essential to your turning it into a reality. The first part of the law of purpose says that a person with a clear purpose will make progress on the roughest road. If you know exactly where you're going, you'll find a way to get there. It doesn't matter how difficult the way or how many obstacles you face, as long as your goal is clear, you'll find a way under, over, or around anything that blocks your path. Now here's an exercise that will start you on your way. Take a pad of paper and write down some clear financial goals for yourself, and then make a plan that extends out over the next 3 to 5 years. Draw up a list of everything you can think of that you can do to begin your forward movement. Organize the list in terms of priorities and begin to work on the most important thing that appears to you. Decide how much you want to earn each year, how much you plan to save and invest of what you earn, and how much you want to be worth when you retire, and how much of an annual return you want to earn on your accumulated savings. The more definite you are, the more likely it is that these numbers will become your reality. The second part of the law of purpose says that The primary reasons why people don't become rich are, first, it never occurs to them, and second, they never decide to. The primary reason that people don't become rich, as I discussed in my audio program, Getting Rich in America, is that it never occurs to them. They never even think about it. So be careful with whom you associate on a regular basis. You will inevitably adopt the mannerisms, values, attitudes, and behaviors of the people with whom you spend the most time. Even if it does occur to you that it would be nice to be wealthy, the second major obstacle to financial success in America is that most people never make a decision to accomplish it. They wish and hope and pray and buy lottery tickets, but they never make a total 100% commitment to paying the price of success in advance so that they can enjoy it in the future. There are some beautiful words attributed to the German philosopher Wolfgang von Goethe, but which were written by the production manager in the introduction to his stage play, Faust. They go like this. Are you in earnest? Seek this very minute. Whatever you can do or dream you can, begin it. Boldness has genius, power, and magic in it. Just begin, and the mind grows heated. Continue, and the task will be completed. The fourth law of wealth creation is the law of enrichment, which says that all lasting wealth comes from enriching others in some way, from adding value and retaining part of it. This law says that anyone who enriches others must themselves be enriched. When you realize that the world is full of men and women driven by expediency to get the very most for the very least of the security, comfort, leisure, love, respect, and fulfillment that they want, you realize that there are unlimited opportunities for you to enrich the lives of others in some way. All you have to do is find your own particular way and then manage your affairs so that you keep a small part of the value that you've added to the life and work of other people. The law of enrichment goes on to say that your current income is a measure of how much you are currently enriching the lives of others. You're paid not what you want, but only what you deserve. You're earning today exactly what you're worth, not a penny more, not a penny less. What you're being paid at this moment represents exactly how much value your efforts represent in the lives of the people who use what you produce. And you can only increase the amount that you're getting by increasing the amount that you're giving. The fifth law of wealth creation is the law of entrepreneurship, which says that more people become wealthy by starting and building their own successful businesses than by all other ways combined. Fully 74% of self-made millionaires in the United States achieve their wealth by starting a business enterprise of some kind and building it up, usually very slowly, so that it not only yielded them a good living, but generated enough excess revenue to eventually make them wealthy. The first part of the law of entrepreneurship simply says, find a need and fill it. This has been the essence of all large and small business success. Look around you, find a need that people have, and find a way to fill it in a cost-effective manner. The second part of the law of entrepreneurship says that wherever there are needs unmet or problems unsolved, there are opportunities to create wealth. The third part of the law of entrepreneurship says that most fortunes come from selling established products or services in established markets to established customers and doing it just a little bit better. All a product or service has to be is 10% newer or better to build a business and to start a fortune. The converse of this principle of entrepreneurship is that it's very risky to start off with a new, unproven, or untried product or service. For example, the industry that's produced more self-made millionaires than any other single industry is the dry cleaning business. This is because dry cleaning is an established service need that's used regularly, it's fairly profitable, and it's required by almost everyone. It isn't that it's not possible to make money with a brand new product or service, but it's a little bit like hoping for a miracle. Miracles do happen, but you can't depend upon them. More people lose their shirts and their hopes by trying to sell something brand new in a brand new market than by any other way. The sixth law of wealth creation is the law of bootstrapping. This law states that entrepreneurs who start with too little capital are usually more successful than those who start with too much. You've probably heard it said that most businesses fail because they don't have enough capital. They run out of money. The fact of the matter is that probably more businesses fail because they start off with too much money rather than too little. The reason for this is simple. The most valuable thing an entrepreneur can bring to a new business idea is energy and imagination. When you have very little money, you have to use your intelligence and your efforts as a substitute for it. You don't have the luxury of using money to smooth out the bumps or to put a cushion under you. When you're down to your last dollar, or if you're starting off with virtually no money at all, you start to think fast very early. You develop street smarts. You learn how to think on your feet and to take action quickly. Some of the smartest and most successful business people have used bootstrapping as the key method of achieving their goals. Many people hold back from starting a business because they're convinced that they need a lot of money. When they go to a bank, they're turned down. The fact is that banks don't lend money for business startups. Banks are in the business of making good loans. That is, loans to people who can back the money that they are borrowing with $2, $3, $4, or $5 for every $1 they're asking the bank to loan. If you don't have that, the bank won't even talk to you. As for venture capitalists, fully 99% of all proposals put into the hands of venture capitalists are turned down. And of the 1% that venture capitalists will back, many of them are failures as well. Most businesses are built up by bootstrapping and by what is called love money. Love money is money that people lend to you or give to you because they love you. Most entrepreneurs finance their own startups, or they finance their startups with money from their parents or members of their family or their friends. This is the most common way of getting a business going in America today. The first part of the law of bootstrapping is, as I mentioned earlier, the most important resources in a new business are energy and imagination. If you have enough energy and imagination, you will ultimately be successful, no matter what happens in the short term. On the other hand, if you lack energy and imagination, you can go through any amount of money and you'll ultimately fail. So the sooner you develop your street smarts, and that depends upon you having very little money to start with, the faster you'll be more successful. The second part of this law says that skill, knowledge, and experience develop in inverse proportion to the amount of capital available. The less capital you have, the smarter you get, and the seventh law of wealth creation is the law of courage, which says that your willingness to risk failure and disappointment is a measure of your desire to be rich. The first part of the law of courage says that no guts, no glory. You've got to be willing to stick your neck out if you want to get your head above the crowd. You have to go out on a limb if you want to get ahead, because that's where the fruit of life is. The second part of the law of courage says that there is nothing to fear but fear itself. This was first said by President Franklin D. Roosevelt during the Great Depression, and it's just as true today. One of the best ways for you to deal with fear is to ask yourself, what's the worst possible thing that can possibly happen? Most of your fear comes from not identifying the worst possible consequences of your situation. Once you've clearly defined what might happen, you can then do everything to make sure that it doesn't occur. The third part of the law of courage says simply, do the thing you fear, and the death of fear is certain. Your ability to confront the things you fear, to face them, and to move ahead in spite of your fears is the way you develop the courage that's essential to long-term success. Dare to go forward. Winston Churchill once said, courage is rightly considered the foremost of the virtues, for upon it all others depend. This is equally true for you and for your desire to become wealthy. The eighth law of wealth creation is the law of risk. This law simply says that there is a direct relationship between the level of risk and the likelihood of loss. People who become wealthy are extremely astute at assessing the level of risk in every situation they deal with. They carefully analyze the ratio of risk to return before deciding to invest their time or money at all. You begin your analysis of risk by realizing that a perfectly safe investment in a money market or savings account can yield you 7 to 8% interest. If you're going to invest your time and money, you must be assured of a return that is substantially higher than that to compensate you for the possibility that you'll lose all or part of your money. When you assess the risk, include all the possible costs. Include your labor at your desired hourly rate as an investment as well. Many entrepreneurs think they're doing well because they don't count their own labor as a cost of doing business. You count your own labor by determining how much you would be paid if you went to work for another company and counting that as a cost of your doing business. You also take the money that you have tied up in the business and calculate what you'd earn on it at a safe rate of return. That is also a cost. It's called an opportunity cost of money, which, combined with your opportunity cost of labor, will give you the real amount of your investment and your risk. The first part of the law of risk comes from Malcolm Forbes, who said, "If it sounds too good to be true, it probably is." One of the greatest wastes of time and life, let alone money, is the pursuit of get-rich-quick schemes which seem to come down the pipeline with astonishing regularity. The only real way to get rich dependably is to get rich slowly. It's hard work, and it takes a long time to accumulate wealth, but you're foolish to seek for faster and easier ways. The second part of the law of risk says that success in wealth creation is the result of avoiding risk in the pursuit of profit. The fact is that entrepreneurs are not risk takers, as is commonly believed. Rather, successful entrepreneurs are risk avoiders. They're very skillful at sidestepping and avoiding risk in the pursuit of adding value and earning profits. It's only to the degree to which you avoid the risks inherent in any economic activity that you become wealthy. The third part of the law of risk says that entrepreneurs take calculated risks, but they are not gamblers. Extensive research on the psychology and patterns of behavior of successful entrepreneurs shows that because they work hard for their money, they have no desire to gamble it away. Entrepreneurs accept that there's a certain amount of risk in anything they do. However, they believe that they can tip the scales to their own advantage. They can moderate the risk by adding their knowledge, skills, and ability to the equation. They are willing to take gambles only when they can personally have an effect on the outcome. You seldom see entrepreneurs in the gambling resorts, and you seldom find them trading in the stock market. If they're in the stock market at all, they have investment portfolios where they store their excess funds for the long term. Their funds are carefully allocated among blue-chip stocks and are supervised by professional money managers. If you ask the average self-made millionaire how the stock market did today, he will tell you, quite frankly, that he doesn't know. They don't follow the stock market because they're not interested. The ninth law of wealth creation is called the law of undue optimism, and it's essential for both entrepreneurship and the creation of wealth. It says, an unwarranted expectancy of success can lead to both the success and failure of a new business venture. Excess optimism is absolutely essential for a person to embark on a new business adventure of any kind. Without undue optimism, without an extremely positive feeling that you'll be successful, you'll have a tendency to play it too safe, as most people do. In order to get started in the first place, you need an attitude of hopefulness and positive expectancy that is much higher than the average. However, this same undue optimism can lead to self-delusion and unreal expectations. So you need to temper your optimism with reality. You need to examine every aspect of the business before you commit your resources to it. You need to seek out the advice of other people who may not be as positive towards your idea as you are, and consider what they have to say carefully before you act. The first part of this law says that the true time period for you to break even will be 3 times longer than your best estimate. Once you've written out your business plan, you should triple your very best estimate of your break-even point and make sure that you have the resources to continue operating that long. Practice frugality at all times and conserve your cash above all else when starting on any new venture. The second part of the law of undue optimism is, whatever your budget is for your venture, it will cost you twice as much as you expect. So be conservative in projecting your sales and revenues, and be liberal, even excessive, in estimating your costs. Always calculate your expenses on the outside, at the highest you can imagine, and when you have them all added up, then add another 20% as a fudge factor to get a more realistic picture of what your financial costs are likely to be. If you exceed your financial results and you do better than you expect, that's wonderful. But practice caution and pessimism in your financial projections to start with. The third part of the law of undue optimism is called Murphy's Law, which you've heard of before. It says, whatever can go wrong will go wrong. An addition to this law says that, of all the possible things that can go wrong, the worst possible thing will go wrong at the worst possible time, and it will cost you the greatest amount of money. People who start their own businesses are convinced, at least initially, that they're going to violate these laws and succeed in spite of them. People who succeed, however, are those who conform to these laws and who have stopped trying to beat them. The 10th law of wealth creation is the law of persistence. It says that if you persist long enough, you must inevitably be successful. Persistence is to the quality of man as carbon is to steel. Your persistence is your measure of your belief in yourself. Persistence is your self-discipline in action. It's your ability to persist that is often your most valuable asset. The first part of the law of persistence says that the entire process of wealth creation is just one important lesson after another. If ever you feel that you've reached the point where you know everything that you need to know, in no time at all you're going to be blindsided by a completely new and unexpected series of problems and difficulties. Mark my words. The second part of the law of persistence says that you stay in business and you achieve success as long as you continue to earn enough money to pay for your mistakes. The freedom to fail is what gives you the opportunity to succeed. You are learning all the time. When you have experiences, either positive or negative, you will learn from them, and what you learn will enable you to win in the end. By the law of accumulation, which I talked about in an earlier session, your ultimate success will be an accumulation of hundreds and even thousands of small actions on your part that gradually add up to a form of critical mass that enables you to create and keep the wealth for which you're working. Perhaps the most important thing you can do is to take time every day to think about your goals and to reflect quietly on the things that you've done right and the things that you would do differently in the future. Remember, action without thinking is the cause of every failure. Financial wealth is within your grasp. Hundreds of thousands of men and women have acquired it in the past, and you can acquire it in the future if you do the same things they did and if you learn the same lessons. The only real limitation on your potential is the level of your desire and the strength of your willingness to persist in the face of adversity. When you set a clear goal, develop a written plan, put your plan into action, and back your actions with determination and perseverance, you must and will eventually be successful. You will become one of the leading men or women of your generation. Everyone makes their living selling something to someone. Everyone is paid both tangibly and intangibly on the basis of how well they sell themselves, their ideas, and their products and services to others. It's not a matter of whether you sell or not, it's only a matter of how good you are at it. Parents, for example, are continually selling values, attitudes, and behaviors to their children, and their children will grow up straight and strong to the degree to which the parents have been good at this job. The very best managers and leaders are invariably described as excellent, low-pressure salespeople. Since people don't like to be told, taught, or talked down to, the most successful human relations experts are those who can present an idea in such a way that the other person will embrace it as his own. President Dwight D. Eisenhower once said that the art of leadership is getting people to do what you want them to do and to think of it as their own idea. In business and industry, and in work and in organizations, you're paid largely on your ability to sell the quality of your work to the people who determine your success in your career. Many people market themselves both aggressively and effectively in their careers, and they move ahead far more rapidly than others who don't, even though they may not be more talented and they may not be producing more or better work. It's all in the selling. Many people are uneasy about the word selling, including many salespeople. But the fact is that the ability to persuade and influence others is central to a happy life. The opposite to influencing and persuading others to your point of view is having no ability to influence or to persuade others, or to be merely a passive agent in the flow of events. People who can't get others to go along with them have very little influence and aren't very highly respected. But people who have developed the ability to be persuasive and convincing in their arguments, on the other hand, are some of the most respected and the most successful people in our society. The ability to sell well is one of the rarest talents in America. Top salespeople are some of the best paid, most respected, and most secure of all professionals. So, whether you are a customer, a manager, a salesperson, or anyone else, you owe it to yourself to become excellent at selling whatever you sell to other people. To speak specifically of the sales profession, according to the Pareto Principle, the top 20% of salespeople sell 80% of the business and earn 80% of the money. Research shows that the top 10% of salespeople open 80% of the new accounts and are some of the highest paid people in the world of business. Wonderfully enough, there's more research available on selling and how to do it effectively today than there ever has been at any other time in human history. Today, we know more about how to succeed in selling than ever before, and that's what we'll cover in this session. Selling involves three essential factors. First comes the product or service. Then comes the salesperson, and then the customer. All three must be ideally suited to each other for a sale to take place. Let me explain. The product or service must be right for the customer, but it also must be right for the salesperson if he or she is going to sell it to the customer. Some salespeople are excellent at selling one type of product or service, and some salespeople are excellent at another. It has very little to do with the product or service itself. It often has to do with the temperament, personality, values, and attitude of the salesperson. You see, it's very hard to sell something that you can't put your whole heart into. Many people have found that by changing products or services, they've gone to the top of their industries, whereas before they were merely spinning their wheels. The starting point of sales success, then, is to make sure that these three factors are in place, that this is the right product or service for you to be selling to the right customer, the one you most enjoy working with. There are 13 laws that apply to sales that you can use to enable yourself to be far more effective and successful. The first is the law of sales, which says nothing happens until a sale takes place. These words come from the great salesman and sales trainer Red Motley. The fact is that a sale is what initiates the entire production process. It activates the factories and provides employment for the workers. It pays salaries and wages. It pays taxes and dividends. And it determines the entire direction of society. Whenever sales are good in any economy, the economy is strong and full of opportunities for growth and prosperity. The very first thing to slow down when the economy begins to soften is the level of sales. The first part of the law of sales says that products and services are sold, not bought. No matter how good a product or service is, in a competitive market and with customers who are busy and preoccupied with many other things, products and services must ultimately be sold, and they require someone to sell them. The skill of selling is therefore one of the guarantors of a happy and prosperous life. The second part of this law says that customers need to be asked to buy. No matter how much a customer likes you or your product, there's always a certain amount of indecision or hesitation at the point of buying, And it's the job of the professional salesperson to help the customer through this difficult moment into the enjoyment of owning and using the product or service. The third part of this law says that 80% of sales are closed after the fifth call or after the fifth closing attempt. In complex sales, which are sales involving several people and several meetings with a client, most sales are closed after the fifth meeting or interaction. In simple sales, which are sales requiring only a single meeting with a client or customer, most sales are closed after the fifth time that the salesperson asks the customer to make a buying decision. It's therefore essential that the salesperson plans the close of the sales conversation in advance and has a variety of different ways to ask for the order. The fourth part of this law says that 50% of salespeople quit after the first call in a complex sale, and 50% of salespeople fail to ask for the order even once in a simple sale. For example, a sales organization I worked with sent out consultants with their salespeople and found that the salespeople were asking for the order an average of 4 times per sales conversation, and their sales weren't very high. They then taught the salespeople to ask for the order at least 5 times in each sales conversation, and their sales doubled within the next 30 days. Very often, each time you ask a customer to make a decision, the customer draws closer to making the final decision. Sadly enough, many salespeople quit when the sale is just within reach by failing to ask for the order one more time. The fifth part of the law of sales comes from the New Testament teaching, which says, "Ask and ye shall receive." There's no miracle to success in selling. Top salespeople just see more people and ask more often. If you want to join the top ranks of sales professionals in your field, you must simply increase your frequency of contact with your customers. Let me tell you another story. A large company in California paid many thousands of dollars to bring in an outside consulting firm to find out why their sales were down. They found that their salespeople had begun to drift in their sales activities, and they were only making 4 customer contacts per week. Immediately upon discovering this, they instituted a control procedure which required that each salesperson meet face-to-face with at least 10 customers per week. Their sales jumped 50% during the very first month. They proved again that no amount of training or skill can replace the need to get head-to-head and knee-to-knee with customers. The second law of selling is the law of ambition, which says, how high you rise is largely determined by how high you want to climb. How far you go in your field, how much money you earn, is not determined solely by external factors. It's determined more by internal factors. It's more often determined by your level of desire and ambition. The first part of the law of ambition says, commit to being the best in your field. The commitment to excellence in your field of selling, more than anything else, will propel you onward and upward and will assure you of great success. All top salespeople got there only after they'd made a firm decision to be the best at what they were doing. The second part of the law of ambition says that to achieve high sales goals, you have to set them in the first place. The starting point of great success in selling is for you to decide how much you want to earn each year and then to decide how much you're going to have to sell in order to earn it. Break your annual sales goals down into monthly goals, weekly goals, and even daily goals. Then, divide your annual income goal by the number 250, which represents the number of working days in an average year, to determine how much you want to earn each day. Divide your daily earnings goal by 8 to determine how much you want to earn per hour. From that moment onward, never do anything that doesn't pay you your desired hourly rate. For example, if you wanted to earn $50,000 a year, dividing that number by 250 would give you $200 per day or $25 per hour for an 8-hour day. From then on, never do anything that you wouldn't pay someone else $25 per hour to do. Don't drop off your dry cleaning or pick up your groceries or socialize on the telephone. These activities don't pay $25 per hour. And if you don't do $25 per hour work, 8 hours a day, it's impossible by the law of cause and effect for you ever to earn $50,000 per year. That's why all top salespeople are extremely well-disciplined in the way they use their time, hour by hour throughout the working day. The third part of the law of ambition says that you can't fly with the eagles if you continue to scratch with the turkeys. This line comes from Zig Ziglar, and it says that in order for you to be the best in your field, you must associate with the best people in your field. At the same time, you must get away from the 80% of salespeople who are going nowhere. Most top salespeople tend to be loners, in that they find, in order to keep themselves positive and motivated and focused on their work, they've got to stay away from the great majority of other salespeople who are not. It's essential that you discipline yourself in this area, and if you want to be a top salesperson, you must get around other top salespeople. The third law of selling is the law of need, which says that every decision to purchase a product or service is an attempt to satisfy a need or relieve a dissatisfaction. One of the most important things you do in successful selling is to put yourself in the shoes of your prospect and see your offering through his or her eyes. The first part of the law of need says that before selling anything to anyone, the salesperson must be clear about the need that he or she is attempting to satisfy. Good salespeople are very good at asking questions and listening intently to the answers. This enables them to focus in on satisfying the most important and pressing needs of the customer with their product or service. The second part of the law of need says that sales success comes from fulfilling existing needs, not creating new ones. Your job is to uncover the needs that already exist, not to attempt to convince a person that they have needs that they may not have thought of in the first place. The third part of the law of need says that the more basic the need, the more basic the sales presentation. For example, if you're selling potatoes, which caters to the need for food, you can sell them very simply by size and weight. Your sales appeal will be to appetite and attractiveness. Your basis of comparison with other foodstuffs will be simple and straightforward. However, the fourth part of this law, the converse of the third part, says that the more complex the need, the more sophisticated and subtle must be the sales presentation. For example, if you're selling perfume to ladies, your advertising and sales approach must be very low-keyed and gentle. Perfume is a delicate subject, used delicately, and is only sold when the salesperson can structure the appeal in such a way that it connects with deep inner needs for beauty and self-realization. The fifth part of the law of need says that the obvious need is often not the real need upon which the product will be purchased. Never assume that you know the need. Each customer is different. The need that caused one customer to buy may not be the same for another customer. If you structure your appeal to the wrong need, you'll be unsuccessful in the sales process. Again, the very best salespeople are very sensitive and attentive to their customers, and they don't even begin to attempt to sell until they're absolutely clear what it is the customer is really interested in buying. The fourth law of selling is the law of problems. This law says that every product or service can be viewed as the solution to a problem, the fulfillment of a need, or the resolution of an uncertainty. As a salesperson, you are basically a professional problem solver. People get from where they are to where they want to go by means of your product or service. The first part of the law of problems says that customers buy solutions, not products or services. A business person, for example, is interested in increasing productivity or sales, decreasing costs, and increasing bottom line profits. The business person doesn't care if you're selling hula hoops or mainframe computers, really. The business person is interested in his or her problem and a possible solution to it, not your product or service or your desire to sell it. When you begin to perceive yourself as a professional problem solver rather than as a salesperson, your success with your customers will go up dramatically. The second part of the law of problems says that the more pressing the problem or need, the less price-sensitive the customer will be and the easier the sale. If a person really needs or can benefit from purchasing a product or service, the customer's concern about price and timing will diminish. If a person is really hungry, he or she will pay a lot to eat. Your job in the sales conversation is to increase the level of the customer's desire for the benefits and enjoyment of your product or service to the point where the price is not a major obstacle to proceeding. The fifth law of selling is the law of persuasion, which says that the process of selling is to convince the customer that he will be better off with the product than he would be with the money necessary to buy the product. You're asking the customer to engage in a trade. You're telling the customer that if the customer gives you their money, the product or service that you will supply will be of greater value to him than either the money or anything else the customer could buy with that same amount of money at the same time. Remember the law of the excluded alternative. Every choice implies a rejection. When you ask a customer to buy from you and to exchange part of his or her limited amount of money, you're asking the customer to forego all other pleasures and satisfactions that are available to the customer with the same amount of money at the same time. And this is a big question. The first part of the law of persuasion is that the customer always acts to satisfy the greatest number of unmet needs in the very best way at the lowest possible price. A major part of your job is to demonstrate that the customer will get more of what he wants faster by purchasing your product or service than the customer would get if the customer either kept the money or bought something else. The second part of the law of persuasion says, proof that others similar to the customer have purchased the product already builds credibility, lowers resistance, and increases sales. Every piece of information that you can present in a sales conversation that shows the customer that other people similar to the customer have already wrestled with this buying decision and decided to go ahead and have been happy as a result moves you closer to making the sale. The third part of the law of persuasion says, half jokingly, that salespeople who don't use testimonials have skinny kids. Testimonial letters, photos of happy customers using and enjoying your product or service, or lists of satisfied customers are extraordinarily powerful influence factors in persuading a person to buy. You must take full advantage of testimonials and acquire them from every source possible and in every way you possibly can. They can make your sales work much easier. You'll find that all top salespeople get there by using testimonials tied directly into the customer they're talking with and the product or services that they're selling. The sixth law of selling is the law of risk, which says that risk is inherent in any investment of time, money, or emotion. Risk is an unavoidable and an inescapable fact of life, and we're always taking actions in every way possible to reduce risk. This is the entire essence of the insurance industry, as I mentioned before. Insurance is simply a way of pooling risks by taking premiums from a large number of people in order to cover the losses that will be suffered by a small number of them. Insuring yourself properly can give you a tremendous sense of inner peace because of the reduction of risk that you feel. The first part of the law of risk says that you're successful in sales to the degree to which you can position yourself as the low-risk provider of your product or service. This is one of the most important concepts in selling and something that you need to build into all of your sales efforts. Many sales fail to materialize because the customer doesn't feel that she'll be safe in the use, enjoyment, or follow-up service and maintenance of your product or service. So you must build this idea of low-risk supplier into every sales presentation. The second part of the law of risk says that the primary psychological obstacle to buying is the fear of failure, the fear of making a mistake in a purchasing decision. The fear of failure is one of the most powerful of all inhibitors of human action. The fear of failure in buying is rooted in previous experiences. Perhaps the customer bought a product that didn't work, or purchased a product or service that ended up costing too much. Since everyone has had bad buying experiences, everyone is conditioned to be cautious and fearful about having those experiences again. This fear of failure is a major psychological block that you must overcome before a purchase decision can be made. The third part of the law of risk simply says that everything you do in a sales interview either raises or lowers the perception of risk and the fear of failure. Because you're asking a person to part with his money and to risk his ego in a sales situation, the purchasing decision is charged with emotion. Everything about you is either adding to or detracting from the perception of risk and uncertainty on the part of the customer. In a sales situation, especially a larger sale, nothing is neutral. Everything counts. Everything that you do is either moving you toward the sale or moving you away from the sale. Never allow yourself the luxury of saying, "Oh, that doesn't matter." Everything matters. Everything counts. Everything is either adding up or taking away. Your job is to make sure that everything you do or say is helpful in some way, in that it lowers the perception of risk and raises the perception of security. The seventh law of selling is the law of trust, one of the most important of all laws in selling. It says that the trust bond between the salesperson and the customer is the foundation of a successful sale. The higher the level of trust between you and your prospective customer, the lower will be the fear of failure and the perception of risk. The first part of the law of trust says that you build trust in a sales relationship by asking questions aimed at the real needs of the customer that your product or service can satisfy. Many salespeople don't realize that an endless series of questions aimed at the customer's life and situation may be of interest temporarily, but these questions don't build the level of trust. It's only when you ask penetrating questions aimed at the real needs of the customer that your product or service can solve that the customer warms to you and begins to trust you and believe in you. The second part of the law of trust says that successful salespeople listen twice as much as they talk. They practice what is called the 70-30 rule. They listen 70% or more of the time, and they talk 30% or less. It's been said often that you have two ears and one mouth, and in a sales conversation, you should use them in that proportion. The best salespeople are superb listeners. Many of them are introverts and not particularly gregarious or outgoing. They're also extremely effective. The third part of the law of trust says that no one ever listened themselves out of a sale. In many cases, if you listen intently enough, if you listen patiently, and if you listen as though there were nothing else in the world more important than the words of the customer at that particular moment, you'll listen yourself into more sales than you can imagine. The fourth part of this law, which is as important as anything that you'll ever learn in selling, is that listening builds trust. There's no better and faster way to build trust between two people than for one to listen to the other. This is true in all relationships. You always like the people best who listen to you the most attentively when you want or need to talk about something that's important to you. Customers are the same. The eighth law of selling is the law of relationships. Applied to sales, it says that success in selling is determined by the ability of the salesperson to form a quality relationship with the customer. Dr. Theodore Levitt of the Harvard Business School, in his book, The Marketing Imagination, explains how marketing and selling has changed over the last few years. He points out that today in selling, because of risk and because of uncertainty and the variety of options available to the customer, the relationship is central. The first part of this law says that the customer wants a relationship first. Before a customer will seriously consider a complex offer of any kind, The customer wants to be sure that he can rely upon the salesperson and the company to fulfill their commitments after the money has changed hands. The second part of this law says that in complex sales, the relationship continues after the sale. Before the customer buys a product or service, the customer is largely independent of the salesperson and the company. The customer doesn't need them in any way. However, once the customer has made a buying decision, the customer then becomes dependent upon the warranties and assurances given by the company for the satisfactory use and enjoyment of the product. Because the relationship continues after the sale and often lasts as long as the customer uses the product or service, the decision to purchase a product or service means the decision to enter into a long-term relationship with the individual and the organization. The third part of the law of relationships in selling says that the relationship is more important than the product or service. Customers largely view products or services as commodities, available from several sources. Because of this, the customer has to decide among competing suppliers, and the decision is almost invariably made on the basis of which salesperson and company the customer feels most comfortable forming a business relationship with. Because relationships are so important in selling, the salesperson should tell the customer very clearly that his philosophy and the philosophy of the company is to enter into a long-term relationship and to maintain that relationship throughout the period of time that the customer will be using the product or service. The most successful salespeople and the most successful companies are those who establish long-term relationships with good customers. They then make every effort to maintain the quality of that relationship through care, attentiveness, sensitivity, dependability, and fast follow-up to complaints and requests, plus excellent service and maintenance. The ninth law of selling is the law of friendship. This is often called the friendship factor, and it says that a person will not buy from you until he is convinced that you are his friend and acting in his best interests. The undeniable fact is that all successful business relationships of any kind are built on friendships between the parties. A good salesperson is really an excellent friend maker. He has an easy ability to turn strangers into friends wherever he goes. He's relaxed, likable, and interested in other people. Other people like him, and in liking him, they want to do business with him. We always prefer to do business with the people we like. And we're psychologically constructed in such a way that we cannot and will not buy from people that we don't like, even if we want the product or service. The more business friendships you have, all things being equal, the more successful you'll be and the more money you'll earn in the field of selling. The tenth law of selling is the law of positioning, which says that the customer's perception of you and your company are his reality and determine his buying behavior. In their excellent book called Positioning, The Battle for Your Mind, authors Reese and Trout point out that every product or service either has or must gain a position in the mind of the customer for that customer to be able to make any kind of a buying decision on it. With proper positioning, your product or service can be seen by the customer as the generic product next to which others are merely substitutes or duplicates. Some examples of excellent positioning are Coca-Cola, Kleenex, and Xerox. In each case, these have become names for both the company and the product, but they're considered by most customers to be the product itself. The first part of the law of positioning says that every element of dress, product, packaging, printing, and promotion creates a perception of some kind. The second part of the law of positioning says that top salespeople position themselves as the preferred choice suppliers of their products and services. In many cases, the customer will pay substantially more for the identical product or service for the simple reason that it is you who are selling it and backing it up. Your position in the customer's mind can be so strong that no other competitor can get to the customer and replace you. The 11th law of selling is the law of perspective, which says that the way that you are viewed by your customers determines your income. This law says that how you are known to your customers, how you are thought about and talked about by your customers when you're not there, largely determines your level of income and your success in selling. The first part of the law of perspective says that when you're viewed by the customer as working for him or her, you'll be in the top 10% of your field. Many thousands of customers who buy from the top salespeople have been interviewed extensively about their buying habits and their reasons for selecting one salesperson over another. The most common reason that they give is that they feel that the salesperson really works for them rather than for their own company. The customers feel that the salesperson cares more about their needs than about making a sale or satisfying the demands of the company that pays their salary. A very good question for you to ask continually is, how would it be useful for me to be viewed by my customers? If you were a fly on the wall and one of your customers was telling one of your prospects about you, what would you want the customer to say? Whatever it is, be sure that everything that you do in your interaction with each customer leaves him or her mentally prepared to say those things about you when you're not present. The second part of the law of perspective says that top money earners in sales are viewed as consultants, helpers, counselors, and advisors to their customers, but not as salespeople. Another finding of the research into the perceptions of customers is that they looked upon the people that they bought from as people who were dedicated to helping them solve their problems or achieve their goals. The 12th law of selling is the law of preparation, which both follows from and precedes everything that I've talked about up to now about successful selling. This law says that the best salespeople prepare thoroughly before every call. This is so simple that it's often overlooked. The hallmark of the true professional, however, is thorough and exhaustive preparation over and over again before every competition. The very best salespeople are those who work on their presentations, on their product knowledge, and their materials repeatedly throughout their sales careers and prior to every new sales contact. You can't imagine a top athlete who didn't train continually before every competition. In fact, the period of training for an athlete consumes far, far more time than the actual competition itself. In every field of endeavor, it's the most thoroughly trained and dedicated professionals who rise to the top. The first part of the law of preparation says that the salesperson with the best knowledge of the real situation of the customer will be most likely to make the sale. The more time you take to thoroughly understand your prospective customer and your prospective customer's situation, the more likely it is that you'll be in a position to sell at the critical moment. The second part of the law of preparation says that sales professionals plan their questions in advance. There's a direct relationship between the quality of the problem-focused questions that you ask a customer and the likelihood of a sale taking place. The only way that you can assure that your questions are penetrating and exact is by writing them out word for word in advance. For example, Ben Feldman, a salesman for the New York Life Insurance Company who was written up in the Guinness Book of Records as the top salesman of all time, used to spend 2 hours every single night reviewing and rehearsing his materials so that he would be sharp and well prepared the next day. In his famous book, The Feldman Method, author Andrew Thompson explains that Ben Feldman's success was largely due to his ability to ask the right questions at the right time. He found that a properly worded question could turn a neutral or negative prospect into an interested customer, sometimes in just a few seconds. The third part of the law of preparation says that the salesperson with the best notes and the best preparation wins. You need to think your call objectives through in advance of meeting the client. Write down and itemize exactly what you hope to accomplish on each visit. After the call, take careful notes and write down everything on the same sheet. Never rely on your memory. There's a Chinese saying which says, "The palest ink is stronger than the most powerful memory." Prior to every sales call, no matter how many times you may have visited the same customer, take a few minutes to review the customer's file, the customer's situation, and your own notes on what's taken place in the past. The top salespeople in every field prepare exhaustively prior to selling, prior to their presentations, and prior to closing. They think everything through in advance, and they leave nothing to chance. Remember, it's the details that make the difference. Finally, the 13th law of selling is the law of perverse motivation. This law says that everyone likes to buy, but no one likes to be sold. People don't like to feel that they're the recipients or the victims of a sales presentation. Most customers are very independent in their minds, and they don't like the thought that they are being manipulated or pressured or coerced into anything. They like to feel as though they're making up their own minds based on good information that's been presented to them. The first part of the law of perverse motivation says simply that the best salesperson is perceived as a person who helps the prospect get what he or she wants and needs. The second part of the law of perverse motivation says that top salespeople are teachers who show their customers how products work to satisfy their needs. If ever your customer feels, even for a moment, that you're trying to sell them into buying something, they'll instantly resist. As selling is something that you do to a person rather than for a person. And since the most important part of selling is the quality of the trust bond that exists between you and the customer, you can't afford to do anything that threatens it. Finally, remember that all things are possible to the salesperson who knows what he's doing, believes in what he's doing, and loves what he's doing. If you're selling the right product or service with the right organization to the right people, your future can be unlimited.